Hello, my beautiful people. This is the Good Mood Podcast, and my name is Dr. Talia Marcogiani. I'm a naturopathic doctor, and this is episode 65, another solo episode called Meet, Play, Love. So this potentially is a controversial podcast. It's not meant to be, but part of the reason that I'm doing a podcast on eating meat is because it has the potential to be controversial, because we've been told for various reasons, for the environment, for ethics, for health reasons, that we should avoid meat. And I am here to correct that notion. Hopefully by the end of this episode, you will feel good about eating meat for your health. Now, I have no interest in changing your moral beliefs or your religious beliefs. So I understand that there are reasons why some people very strongly will not consume meat or feel very strongly about not consuming meat. That's not what I'm here for. What I'm here for is to debunk certain notions, to describe the benefits of eating meat for your health, what nutrients it contains, how those nutrients are unique compared to other foods, and also talk about the environment, because there's a lot of talk, and I have many friends who avoid red meat in order to save the planet. And while a very noble feat, I want to argue against that and add some more information to the pool. So those of you who know my background, I grew up eating a standard American diet. I ate margarine. I followed sort of this low-fat diet as a kid. Our family did. My mom was into Weight Watchers and she was into eating healthy, but the nutrition information at the time led us down a low-fat path, high fiber, seed oils. So we probably cooked with vegetable oil, ate margarine, avoided red meat. I think most of my protein came from things like chicken, turkey. And around the time I was in first or second year university, I decided to become a vegetarian. I was a vegetarian for a few years throughout university and when I moved to South America, to Colombia. And throughout that time, I dabbled in veganism. So it was about a year that I was a vegan, about 5 years I was a vegetarian. So I thought I was eating healthy. I thought I was being intentional. I had an awareness of nutrition and what I was putting in my body. And I thought about what I ate. I usually looked at food in terms of calories. Again, that's what I was taught at the time. And I thought low-fat foods were better. Now we know there's more information. We have better information. I am also better able to sort through the information available. And my eating habits are very different. But needless to say, at the end of those 5 years, I was suffering from various nutrient deficiencies. I was depressed. I was dealing with a lot of weight gain, bloating, fatigue. And so I began eating meat. While I was vegetarian, though, I read this book called The Ethics of What We Eat by Peter Singer. And I thought it was very thought-provoking, and it encouraged me on the path of vegetarian and veganism. I thought this was the way to eat. This was the healthy way to eat. Lots of vegetables, lots of fiber, lots of plant-based protein, beans, legumes. And it wasn't until my health started to fail that I looked at a different way. So I forget who said this, but there was a podcast I was listening to where a doctor said that according to him, disease boils down to two things, excess and deficiency. This is true in Chinese medicines. If you divide all of Chinese medicine into two camps, you have excess and deficiency. So essentially nutrient deficiency and toxicity. There, you know, so not enough stuff that the body needs to function, and or too much of something or an accumulation of something that is harmful to the body. And then over time, I think these nutrient deficiencies, these excesses, they start to manifest as imbalances. When they've gone on long enough, you start to see imbalances emerge. So you might see chronic immune system activation or autoimmunity. You might see insulin resistance. You might see organ damage like fatty liver or cirrhosis. you might have issues with your stress response or issues with the brain, with your brain cells or organelles within the cells, like the mitochondria. But I actually do believe that excesses and deficiencies lie at the root of most, if not all, of the disease processes and imbalances we can experience. And I want you to think of that when you're listening to this podcast and think of, you know, what might be causing the increase in diseases that we're seeing today? What excesses and what deficiencies might be at play, considering what we've been told about what a healthy diet is? So A History of Humanity, there's an article by Neil Mann called A Brief History of Meat in the Human Diet and Current Health Implications. So about 4 million years ago, our brain started increasing about threefold. So we have three times the size of the brain of the Australopithecus, I think it's called. And it's, this process is called encephalization. And in order to grow our brains that big, it's hypothesized that we needed DHA and arachidonic acid, two fatty acids that are actually found in brain tissue. And we also needed enough nutrients to support a very metabolically active brain. Our brain requires nine times the energy of the rest of the body. And so this change in brain size occurred during a time when we started to more intentionally consume meat. We started to develop tools that allowed us to crack open the skulls of animals and consume their brain tissue, giving us a source of DHA. And so there's this idea, and you know, it's pretty pervasive in the anthropological literature, that we evolved alongside meat. And that part of what makes us human are large brains that are larger and more metabolically active than any other animal our size. We're formed in the presence of us being able to obtain and cook meat. There's an experiment that was done where they took vegetarians and they took meat eaters and they quizzed them on what they felt about meat. So they showed them pictures of meat dishes and fish dishes, and they asked them what they thought about those foods. And in the vegetarians, they described that the fish and meat dishes elicited lower desire for them to eat. They experienced lower pleasantness and lower arousal subjectively. And the omnivores looked at those dishes and said, looks delicious. But the vegetarians were like, no, disgusting. That I don't find those foods pleasant. I don't find those foods delicious. Well, we know that we can lie to ourselves and others. And so they hooked the brains of both the vegetarians and the omnivores up to a device that measures something called ERPs, or event-related potentials. So these are little spikes in brain activity that are usually associated with something interesting. So if something interests you, your brain will spike a lot of ERPs. And they found that there was no difference between the vegetarians and the omnivores when they were shown the plates of meat and fish in their ERP measures. And so in conclusion, all humans seem to respond positively at a primal level to meat and fish and animal foods. So again, more evidence that we were programmed to eat meat. Dr. Weston A. Price, who I've talked about in other podcasts, in the 1930s, when he did his voyage, where he went around the world and looked at hunter-gatherer populations that still existed at the time and what they ate, he found no population was vegan. So they prized animal foods. All of the populations prized at least some sort of fish or dairy or eggs. They prized organs, and they ate animal foods when they could get them. So many populations were vegetarian, or some were, but many of them were not vegetarian by choice. So what makes meat so special? So let's talk first about protein, because we often hear that protein is not important, or we eat too much protein. Okay, well, protein makes up about 16% of the human body. It's required for our structure. So bones, muscles, connective tissues, skin, hair, nails, our amino acids. So amino acids make up protein. They're the building blocks of protein. They create our hormones and neurotransmitters. And these neurotransmitters, these signaling molecules, regulate our mood, gene signaling. Tryptophan is an amino acid that's used to make serotonin and melatonin, which are hormones that enable us to regulate our feelings of well-being and our circadian rhythms and our sleep. Cysteine is needed to make glutathione, the main antioxidant in the body that neutralizes cancer-causing free radicals, prevents damage to our DNA, and protects us from the incessant chemical onslaught of our increasingly toxic lives. Glycine and GABA, they calm the nervous system. They prevent overactivation of our brain's fear centers and soothe anxiety. Glycine is also used in antioxidant function. It helps make collagen, which is the structural protein in our body. Glutamine stimulates the nervous system, and it fuels our gut and kidney cells, allowing us to absorb the nutrients from our food and to filter waste from our bodies. So essentially, we are a protein sac filled with water. And this sac hums along with the metabolic activity that is orchestrated by the tens of thousands of enzymes that make things happen in the body. And these enzymes are also protein. And so we need protein in our diet. And we'll go on again, because with protein, it's important as well for blood sugar regulation and for brain function. So do you feel that feeling of being fried and fatigued at the end of the day? Do you experience cravings at the end of the day? Do you feel jittery? Do you feel anxious? Do you have a strong startle reflex? Do you get decision fatigue? So do you feel totally wiped, burnt out at the end of the day? It's difficult to decide that you want to go and do something wholesome, like go for a walk or meet up with a friend, and all you want to do is scroll, open up a bottle of wine. Do you experience low mood, low motivation, low drive? Do you experience anxiety, especially in the afternoon or in the morning? Do you have issues sleeping, issues staying asleep, difficulty getting up in the morning? These are all symptoms of blood sugar dysregulation that is fixed by increasing protein, especially in the morning, especially earlier on in the day, having protein with every meal. Lack of motivation and drive and addictions or difficulty concentrating, initiating and staying on task are all symptoms of low dopamine, which is another neurotransmitter in our brain. And they're symptoms of many mental health conditions, from depression to ADHD. Dopamine requires an amino acid called tyrosine to get made. Tyrosine is the building block of dopamine. And higher protein diets, especially higher meat diets, push tyrosine synthesis pathways, which help to stabilize our mood and increase motivation, and increase energy, and increase mental faculties, being able to word recall, to come up with ideas, to feel mentally there, to extract meaning from life, and to experience drive, the drive to accomplish tasks and seek pleasure. All of these things come from a diet higher in protein. When it comes to dietary protein, not all are created equal. So we hear that, you know, a beef burger is just as good as a Beyond Beef burger in terms of the protein, that all you need to look at in your food label is how many grams of protein are in it. This is not true. So first of all, there are some concepts. Complete protein is a protein that has all 9 essential amino acids. So these 9 essential amino acids are not synthesized by the body, and they must be obtained exclusively from your diet. So if you don't get them from diet, you don't make them at all. Tryptophan being one. Tryptophan, we'll talk about later, but it makes serotonin, melatonin, and it's mostly found in poultry, eggs, animal foods. Many vegetarian sources of protein are not complete proteins, right? So beans, rice, they don't contain all 9 amino acids. And therefore, one practice that was done more popularly in the 90s was this thing called protein combining. We'd have rice and beans together to avoid deficiency of specific amino acids. But the important thing is that proteins also, they differ in their absorbability and their bioavailability. So some vegan foods or some plant-based foods that are rich in protein, they actually contain anti-nutrients. And this is a concept that's important because anti-nutrients are chemicals and compounds that actually prevent the absorption and the bioavailability of the nutrients from our foods. These are things like phytates, phytic acid, lectins, oxalates, certain fibers. So they bind up nutrients such as protein and make them difficult to digest or impossible to digest and absorb. So the protein digestibility of whey from dairy or egg is about 100%. And that means that 100% of the protein from these foods is absorbed. And in contrast, only 75% of the protein in black beans gets absorbed. And even more dismally, those who hope to get a significant source of their protein from peanut butter in their, on their morning toast, they're only absorbing about 52% of it. So my patients are like, I put peanut butter on my toast in the morning for my protein. And I encourage them to look at actually how much protein is in that peanut butter. So I put a lot. Okay, well, 2 tablespoons is about 5 grams of protein. And if only 52% of that is getting absorbed, that's a little bit more than 2.5 grams of protein. And we'll talk about how much protein we should be aiming for. So the RDA for protein is 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight for the average person. But when it comes to supporting optimal health, dealing with the excess stress in our society, in our environment, regulating our hormones, supporting brain health and mental health, dealing with all the complexity of our lives, I think that RDAs are actually set quite low. And in my opinion, you know, and also the opinions of others and in the work of people that focus on things like adrenal function and our hypothalamic adrenal pituitary adrenal access, our HPA access, our stress response, there's a universal recommendation to eat more protein. If you suffer from mental health issues, if you have chronic stress, if you have hormonal imbalances, if you suffer from obesity, if you have insulin resistance or diabetes, and 88% of people have insulin resistance, if you have cardiovascular disease, if you have certain cancers, autoimmune disease, it's helpful to, it depends for each of those conditions, but generally we want to be eating enough protein to support our body needs, but also to put on enough to repair all of the damaged proteins that happen throughout the wear and tear, like the wear and tear of our daily lives. And then we also want to be putting on muscle mass. We want to maintain this robustness, this strong bone density, strong brain mass, strong muscle mass, so that we can live long, healthy, active lives. And so I recommend to my patients, if they can, and I've heard this recommendation in other places, to try and get a gram of protein per pound of body weight per day. So those people who are particularly active, you know, who need to lose weight, who are obtaining their protein from lower absorbable sources, you might even need higher amounts. So people who have insulin resistance, conditions like PCOS, depression, and anxiety, I try and recommend 30 grams of protein in the morning on waking and at least 30 grams per meal to balance blood sugar, to fuel neurotransmitter synthesis, to sustain energy throughout the day, to provide this grounding focus and this confidence. And so the RDA is kind of there just to prevent muscle wasting. And if the protein sources are difficult to digest and low quality, you probably need even more. So some people are worried about too much protein and its effect on the kidneys, the idea that amino acids are broken down into nitrogen, and that can affect kidney health. But there was a 1-year crossover study that showed that active men who consumed about 3 grams of protein per kilo of body weight had no ill effects from this, and they had no issue with their kidney health. So you want to try and understand how much protein your diet delivers. So while something like quinoa is a complete protein, it contains all 9 essential amino acids. That's why it gets such a rave review when it comes to protein content, but it only contains 8 grams of protein per cup. And a cup of black beans, it contains 39 grams of protein per cup, but only 29 grams of that will be absorbed, right? Because it's only 75% absorbability. There's something called the DIAS score, D-I-A-A-S, and it measures protein quality, right? So it's looking at the absorbability, the bioavailability, the protein completeness. And so beef and egg are the highest. They have the highest DIAS score of 1.13. Both of them have the same. Pork has a Dias score of 0.991, fish 0.934. And then you start getting into the plant-sourced proteins. You have rice, which has a Dias score that drops to 0.595. And look at your bag of rice. And so that's one of the highest quality plant proteins. But look at how much protein is in rice. It's like a gram. Kidney beans have a score of 0.588. So it's less than half of that of beef and eggs. So nothing compares to the bioavailability, the completeness, the absorbability of meat and animal foods for protein. So remember, when we have plant foods, they contain phytic acid, they contain lectins, they contain fiber, which is good for us, but it prevents the absorption of these nutrients. So we can't just look at the labels and assume that that's what we're actually absorbing and getting. Not only do these anti-nutrients, like oxalates, lectins, phytic acid, not only do they impede protein absorption, they also impede our ability to absorb minerals like calcium, magnesium, iron, zinc. So let's get into the nutrients. So the B vitamins, vitamin B12. So we know that we need to get B12 if we're not eating meat, because B12 only comes from animal foods. And so if you're vegan, vegetarian, you're likely supplementing with B12. Although I do, and I have been seeing low B12 in many patients who are omnivores. And so this maybe speaks to, we need better bioavailable sources of B12. We're probably not eating enough. And we might need more B12 if we're stressed. So B12 we need for detoxification, for methylation, for neurotransmitter synthesis, and for energy metabolism. Methylation is this important process that helps our brain get fuel. It helps us make neurotransmitters. It helps us with processing hormones in the body. Not all of us methylate that well. And we might need more B12, folate, choline, or other nutrients that support methylation in order to have better focus, have better mood, better thyroid function, liver function. Methylation is a big thing in my practice. And for more on it, check out the episode with Christina Carew. So our gut bacteria can make B12, but we don't actually, it's unclear how much we actually absorb from the colon. And B12 deficiency is serious. So I know someone who suffered permanent neurological damage leading to seizures and a coma, almost death from a B12 deficiency. This was a very health aware, plant-based person that I met in Mexico. And the neurological damage caused by B12, it's irreversible. I've had some patients who've had numbness and paresthesia and neuropathy because B12 myelinates our nerves. It's involved in coding and supporting our nerves. And when that myelin sheath breaks down and wears down, we start to experience multiple sclerosis or MS-like symptoms. And so it's things like numbness, tingling, pain, nerve symptoms. The progress of restoring B12 levels and healing from these symptoms once B12 deficiency has become severe is not always linear. B12 deficiency is associated with severe neuropsychiatric symptoms, so symptoms that can mimic severe bipolar disorder and psychosis or schizophrenia. And once you restore B12 or give injections, then the symptoms resolve. There is a case study in my Feed Your Head course that I talk about where a patient who was vegetarian was misdiagnosed with depression. She was given electric shock therapy because she had treatment-resistant psychosis. She was catatonic. She was incontinent, meaning she would wet herself and couldn't control her bladder, bowels. And then they discovered that she was B12 deficient. So they started giving her B12 and her symptoms completely reversed. So the reference range for B12, because you can check this in your blood, is something like 130 to 652 picomoles per liter. But this is quite an outdated range, and we try and actually aim for over 600. This is closer to the Japanese range. Many people will experience symptoms of deficiency when your B12 gets under 400. And I've had patients who have had severe depression and mental health issues with their B12 under 200 to find that slowly things reverse as we replenish their levels. So often you might be told that your levels are normal and you're still operating at a suboptimal level of B12. Low B12 is associated with Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and a decrease in brain volume. So people who had lower B12 levels had smaller brains. B6 is also highly, much more bioavailable from animal foods than from plant foods. And B6 is needed to make serotonin. So we have tryptophan that gets turned into 5-HTP. So tryptophan is the amino acid from poultry, eggs. It gets turned into 5-HTP. The 5-HTP gets turned into serotonin, and the serotonin can get converted into melatonin. We need B6 for a number of these steps. B6 is also needed for dopamine synthesis. It's needed for liver function, for hormonal processing. It's one of the key nutrients that we recommend for PMS, PMDD. It's depleted with the oral contraceptive pill. So this could be the reason why there's this large Danish study that showed that oral contraceptives cause depression. And so B6 for depression and anxiety is absolutely crucial. So it can be found in plant foods like grains and certain legumes, but it's much more bioavailable from animal foods like meat and liver. Vitamin B2, a riboflavin, it's needed for mitochondrial health, for methylation, just like B12. It's needed to, and it's also a remedy for migraines. So it might be that there's this hypothesis that migraines are caused by a dysfunctional mitochondria that causes inflammation, issues with detoxification, and creating energy in the brain. And there have been many studies on riboflavin for migraines. Riboflavin, again, to get it from plants, you need to eat 3 pounds of spinach, or you can get 100 milligrams of kidney or liver. So it's much more bioavailable from animal foods, and it's much more abundant in organ meats like kidney or liver. Nutrients like vitamin A. So vitamin A, the real vitamin A is retinol. And this is an active form that is not found in plant foods. So beta carotene or other carotenoids are found in plant foods. They have to be converted to vitamin A. We don't do that step very well. And so liver, eggs, these are the sources of vitamin A in the diet. Vitamin K2. So we don't actually distinguish between K1 and K2 yet, although they're two completely different vitamins. They're fat-soluble vitamins. So fat-soluble vitamins A, D, E, and K are very abundant in liver, in grass-fed tallow, grass-fed milk, grass-fed butter. So very abundant in animal foods. K2 is a completely different version of vitamin K. It's the active vitamin. It's associated with decreased cardiovascular health, mortality, and all-cause mortality. So the more vitamin K2 in your body, the less your chance of dying from any condition, and the less your chance of dying from heart disease. And this is because one of vitamin K2's job is to remove calcium and plaques from the arteries and deposit that calcium in bone. So it's really important for bone density and bone mass, calcium balance in the body, and for reducing heart disease, atherosclerosis. We also have vitamin D, right? So the other fat-soluble vitamin. So this, the active form, vitamin D3, is only found in animal foods. Even the supplements are derived from lanolin and sheep's wool. So it's not technically even a vegan supplement. And D regulates over 1,000 different genes in the body. And about 90% of North Americans are deficient. Vitamin D supplements are animal sourced. Vitamin D is associated with serotonin synthesis in the brain, with bone density, with immune function, reduces autoimmunity, supports the immune system. Sleep and circadian rhythms are associated with vitamin D. Vitamin D deficiency has been implicated in sleep apnea and so on and so on. So a really important hormone, more than a vitamin, in the body that there are tens of thousands of studies on at this point. You can Google vitamin D plus whatever health condition you want to see if it's associated, and you'll probably find some study. So hair loss, you know, brain function, memory, etc. It's prescribed pretty much universally in my practice. I encourage people to get their levels tested because we can't predict what level someone might need in terms of supplementation. So it is in certain animal foods, like it's possible to get from liver, to get from grass-fed milk, butter, ghee, but it also, and it really though, the main source of vitamin D is from the sun. And so the cholesterol in our skin, so you need enough cholesterol, and we'll talk about that. The cholesterol in our skin interacts with UVB radiation from the sun and makes vitamin D in our skin. So sun exposure is crucial for vitamin D. In Canada, we're not getting nearly enough sun exposure, especially this time of year, and therefore supplementation is pretty much necessary. But it's helpful to work with somebody who can guide you in supplementation, look at blood levels, and see how well you're absorbing and utilizing vitamin D so you can stay within the sweet spot for optimal functioning. So there is a plant-based source of vitamin D, vitamin D2. It comes from mushrooms, but not as effective, needs to be converted, magnesium's needed for the conversion. We have some minerals. So zinc is essential for immune function, skin health, neurogenesis, making new brain cells, memory and cognition. It makes serotonin. It's needed for gut integrity. It's needed for stomach acid production, neurotransmitter synthesis, and hormonal health, among other essential functions. So super important mineral, zinc. And zinc is essentially only found in animal foods. It's found in beef, in oysters. If you consume zinc with phytic acid or lectins, these anti-nutrients that we talked about, none of it is absorbed. So there was a study when tortillas were consumed with oysters, which are very rich in zinc. The tortillas completely inhibited the zinc absorption. And there's a similar pattern for magnesium and calcium, which we'll talk about, and iron. So iron is a nutrient that's near and dear to my heart. It's important for supplying our tissues with oxygen, right? So if you don't have enough iron, you're at risk for developing anemia, which means you literally are not making enough red blood cells to function, to send energy throughout your body or send oxygen throughout your body to make energy. And that often looks like low iron and or anemia can look like anxiety, because what happens is when our iron levels are low, our oxygen carrying capacity drops, and we're not able to send as much oxygen to our tissues with every heartbeat. Think of it as like cars on a road or taxis on a road. And so what needs to happen is our heart will beat more quickly. And this triggers our nervous system to perceive itself as experiencing anxiety. And so low iron low iron is a major cause of someone feeling anxiety. We also need iron to make dopamine. And so low motivation, low drive that we talked about, feeling sluggish, difficulty with word recall, difficulty coming up with names for things that you know, but you can't remember the word for, the name for, are all symptoms of iron deficiency, or rather dopamine deficiency, that could be related to low iron. So if you're menstruating, you're likely, already possibly operating at suboptimal iron levels because of the blood loss that's happening monthly. And you might experience fatigue, dry skin, chronic infections. You might have heavy periods. There's this vicious cycle that happens that when iron is low, blood's a little bit thinner. And so we can bleed more heavily. We need iron for thyroid function, which I mentioned, and fertility. And iron from plant foods is just not as bioavailable, not as easily absorbed. Phytic acid, lectins impair it, and the form of iron, so it's non-heme iron, is not as well absorbed. So there are plant-based supplements of iron. And so I will recommend those to patients, especially if you're deficient. You're probably not going to get enough iron from animal foods or from meat, but really the source of iron that we're absorbing and utilizing into the body from our diet is meat. And I'll sometimes recommend desiccated liver supplements if somebody is deficient in iron, zinc, fat-soluble vitamins, B vitamins, then I'll often put them on a functional food. If you're not going to eat liver or kidney, we might put you on a supplement of desiccated or chopped up freeze-dried liver. It's what I take. So we have vitamin D, then we have magnesium. So this is actually new to me. I did not think that magnesium came from animal foods, but there's 100 milligrams of magnesium per pound of muscle meat, which is interesting. And so you'd have to eat about 2 pounds of kale to get 400 milligrams of magnesium per day. But it also means you'd have to eat 4 pounds of muscle meat to get 400 milligrams of magnesium per day. But because of the oxalates, the phytates, all the anti-nutrients in kale, you're probably not going to absorb that magnesium. And so I don't know how we would have got magnesium, probably from mineral water back in the day. That's the hypothesis, is that we'd get about 100 milligrams from mineral water, 100 milligrams from meat. And then we also had better soil quality back in the day. So we'll talk about the soil later on in this podcast, but this depleting and tilling of the soil has affected magnesium levels in the foods we're eating. And so we probably need to supplement magnesium, particularly if you're dealing with sleep issues, with anxiety, with insulin resistance. So magnesium deficiency in the presence of a high sugar diet leads to insulin resistance in mice. And we need magnesium for insulin signaling, PMS, muscle cramps, menstrual cramps, migraines, fatigue, constipation, all associated with magnesium deficiency. So it's pretty universal. Pretty much every one of my patients is experiencing symptoms of some sort of magnesium deficiency, sometimes severe, sometimes more mild. It's again, just like vitamin D, a pretty universal recommendation. So EPA and DHA are our omega-3 fatty acids. They're found in fish and in algae, and they are found in animal foods, so in meat. They're essential for cell membranes and brain function. And so remember Neil Mann's article that our brain mass tripled in size once we started to obtain DHA in our diet. We can make DHA from ALA, which is found in flax and walnuts, but many of us can't convert it efficiently. So it's about 18% of our ALA can be converted to DHA. And we need zinc for that process. And iron. So two nutrients that if you're not eating meat, how are you getting those? So typically people that don't eat meat, vegetarians and vegans, have lower EPA and DHA than meat eaters. And we have studied EPA for the therapeutic antidepressant benefit. It's anti-inflammatory. And usually plant-based, so EPA is very difficult to get from just algae. And doses that are therapeutic are something like 1 to 3 grams a day of EPA. So EPA is involved in lowering inflammation in the brain and reducing depressive symptoms. DHA is associated with brain mass in supporting brain mass development during pregnancy, so fetal brain development and breastfeeding. And DHA also contributes to our brain mass. So it's helping us actually like form and maintain brain size. And so likely was the reason that our brains grew when we were able to access actual brain tissue to consume from the skulls of the animals that we killed or found. We have some other nutrients. So we have choline. This is a nutrient that's very near and dear to my heart that I recommend because of all of the functions that it has, again, not really found in plant foods. You can find it in things like Brussels sprouts, but you need to eat pounds and pounds of them to get enough choline. Choline is found in liver and egg yolks. Those are the main sources of choline. Sometimes I'll recommend either a desiccated liver supplement for people to get their choline, or I'll recommend a lecithin supplement, which is either from soy or sunflower, that provides a really high amount of choline. You need about 400 milligrams of choline a day for brain function. So choline gets converted to phosphatidylcholine, which is a phospholipid. It forms our cell membranes. Cell membranes, it's worth talking about here. So if you're anxious, you may identify with the feeling of like your nerves being raw and that scattered sort of raw nerve feeling. So cell membranes are the coating of, so first of all, they keep things within our cells. They also support, like our nerve cells are, they're like electrical wiring. So our brain, our nervous system is essentially electrical in nature. If you ever rip the walls down from your home, you'll find that the electrical wiring in your house has this rubber insulation on it. So think of that rubber insulation as an analogy to our cell membranes. Our cell membranes coat and protect our nerves. They keep the cell contents intact. They make sure that our cells are strong but fluid. And if we don't have well-functioning cell membranes, we experience that raw nerve feeling. We experience jitteriness, we experience scatteredness, neuroses. We need phosphatidylcholine to liquefy bile. So without enough choline, you're at risk for gallstones, choline and difficulty with digestion, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth or SIBO, this condition where your bacteria creep up into your small intestine, creating bloating, gas, other IBS symptoms. Constipation, diarrhea, possibly is from a lack of bile released into the small intestine, which clears and kills all that stuff, and an issue with motility, and choline can help with that. We need choline for methylation. Choline deficiency can result in a non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So if you want to give someone non-alcoholic fatty liver disease or fatty liver, you deprive them of choline. Patients in the hospital fed parental nutrition, which is like a feeding tube. When they left choline out of the nutrients they were given in their feeding tubes, they all developed fatty liver. And we also need choline to make acetylcholine, which is a neurotransmitter in our brain that's involved in focus, concentration, sort of like flow states. It also is involved in gut motility. And so choline we need for motility, for gallbladder function, for liver function, for brain function, for acetylcholine production, and so on. So a very, and it's absolutely essential in pregnancy. It a choline deficiency can result in IQ points dropping from the baby once they're born. So super important for fetal brain and nervous system development. So again, it's found in liver and egg yolks. There's an amino acid called taurine. Taurine is synthesized into GABA, which is our calming neurotransmitter. It's relaxing. And it is GABA deficiency is involved in anxiety. When you're anxious, the anti-anxiety drugs, like all of the benzodiazepines, like lorazepam, Ativan, they're all involved in boosting GABA in the brain. Taurine and magnesium are connected. So sometimes people are not able to absorb magnesium as well. It doesn't get into their brain properly. Taurine helps with magnesium absorption, supports magnesium's relaxing effects. Taurine also reduces something called glycation end products or ages that are literally things that age you. So they're these sticky kind of things that that hang onto red blood cells if you have insulin resistance or diabetes. So the end stage of diabetes usually results in small blood vessel issues. So kidney issues, issues with your eyes, issues with the extremities. And this is likely due to the formation of advanced glycation end products where our blood can't flow as smoothly, it's stickier, and it can't get into those small capillaries. Taurine is essential for reducing this. Again, taurine found in meat. We talked about tryptophan. It makes serotonin, which gets converted into melatonin. So it makes both of them. And tryptophan requires zinc, B6, magnesium to be converted into serotonin. Found mostly in animal products. It's an essential amino acid, so can't be created by your body. And it's rare in plants. There's another nutrient called carnitine. So carnitine's job is to shuttle fatty acids across the mitochondrial membrane. And this is a process, and then those fatty acids can be broken down into energy in this process called beta oxidation. So it's this, we need carnitine if we're going to use fat for fuel. So fat-based metabolism, like ketosis, using fat for fuel, is extremely important to our brain. it improves mitochondrial function and it improves our metabolism. And there was a study in which adding carnitine to the diet of geriatric mice produced more youthful behavior in them. Studies show that there were significantly lower levels of carnitine in the brains of people who were depressed. And carnitine has actually been shown as an antidepressant treatment. It's more effective at treating depression than placebo. So we could say more about the nutrient density of meat and animal food. So liver, organs. So of all the foods and their nutrient density, like when you think of micronutrient density, you probably aren't thinking of like hamburger. And that's a mistake. You should be thinking of hamburger, because of the six top micronutrient dense foods, so the foods that have the most vitamins, minerals, peptides, the top six foods were liver, oyster, kidney, cheese, eggs, and roe. All the top six were animal foods. The next, number seven, was leafy greens. So plant foods don't even make it to the top five. And also consider that even though plant foods like leafy greens are nutrient dense, they also contain phytic acid and oxalic acid, oxalates, that are going to prevent absorption of the minerals that they contain. And I'm not saying plant foods are bad. That's not the point of this podcast, but the point is to emphasize the importance of animal foods and meat, especially organ meats, for nutrient density and the bioavailability, the absorbability, and the quality of the nutrients that these foods contain. So of the most nutrient dense foods on the planet, the top six are animal foods. And the number one is liver. So because this is a mental health podcast, let's talk about mental health. So people that don't eat meat, vegetarians, people that don't eat any animal products at all, vegans, how is their mental health? So I know from my practice what I think, but let's talk about a couple of studies. So in a study of 9,000 Australian women, vegetarians had significantly more mental health issues, higher levels of iron deficiency, were more likely taking prescription and non-prescription medications than those who were not vegetarians. The study authors concluded, our results show that a vegetarian diet is associated with poor health, higher incidences of cancer, allergies, and mental health disorders, a higher need for healthcare, and poor quality of life. So this is a first world country, Australia. In France, depressive symptoms were more common in vegetarians than those who excluded red meat from their diet. In Germany, vegetarians demonstrated higher rates of mental disorders than those eating meat. And there was a progression in these conditions where the less meat that was eaten, the more depression was seen. So it was not necessarily the fact that someone was vegetarian. It was that these animal foods are conferring some sort of benefit, or at least the correlation would suggest. In Finland and Sweden, vegetarians were 3 to 4 times more likely to experience seasonal affective disorder, where you experience low mood, depression, dysthymia at the change of season. So of all these studies, it was a total of 130,000 people. There's a correlation between plant-based diets or lack of meat in the diet and anxiety and depression. I think personally that if we're thinking about what, like we evolved over millennia. We started eating meat 2 to 2.5 million years ago. Our brains grew in the presence of meat. And we have cultures, ancient cultures that are revolved around meat. So the Hadza, hunter-gatherer community in Tanzania, when their culture revolves around meat. The heroes in their culture are good hunters. When they ask, like, what's their favorite day on earth? It's the day that they had this amazing kill. And so I have this sense that our nervous system is wired. And we heard that study about the ERP, the event-related potentials, where when humans look at plates of meat, their brain lights up and gets excited, even if you don't think you like it. So I have this sense that when we ate meat, this primal satisfaction and signal of abundance was signaled to our body. So think about it. You're with your community, your hunter-gatherer group, you're looking for food. You don't know when you're going to get your next meal. You kill an animal, you bring it home. Everybody sits around the fire, cooks it, shares it. And this is where culture forms. This is where songs are created and dance, and everyone feels calm and happy and healthy. And you eat as much as you can and you're full and your body is grounded. Your nervous system is regulated. You're not neurotic. In contrast, this to subsistence foods. So think of like what it takes to consume an acorn. There's a lot of people who are embracing this sort of foraging lifestyle where they're taking things like acorns and they're breaking them down. Acorns, tons of anti-nutrients in acorns, very difficult to digest. Think about legumes. You can't just eat legumes. You've got to pressure cook them, double boil them. You've got to break down the phytic acid in them and the lectins in them so you can even start to absorb them. And even then they're not fully absorbed. When we were eating these more subsistence foods, it would signal scarcity to the body. Your body would start to conserve. And we'll talk more about this with the different fat signals. But I feel this, that meat, that higher protein diets, they create this sense of safety in the body. When we think of polyvagal theory, we have our shutdown, we have fight or flight, and then we have safe and social. I feel like meat, protein, animal foods trigger this sense of safe and social in the body. I am fed, I'm abundant, stress hormones are lower, I feel calm, I feel full, everything's working well. So what about cholesterol? What about fat, saturated fat? So let's start on my spiel about saturated fat. So up until the 1900s, so the early 1900s, 99% of the fats in the human diet came from animal fats. So 99% of our fats were meat, butter, lard, tallow, eggs, whole fat milk, etc. And during that time, the main diseases were infectious. It was things like tuberculosis. 1.2% of the population was obese at that time. And we were eating lard, like tallow. The first published case study of a heart attack was in 1912. Before that, no one had ever heard of heart disease. The man that invented the ECG, the EKG, which is used routinely in hospitals to diagnose heart attacks, he was lab. He couldn't patent it because no one saw a use for it. In 1900, deaths from cancer were about 5 to 8% of total deaths. In 1935, only about 0.37%, so not like a third of a percent of the US population had type 2 diabetes, which is an endpoint disease state in metabolic dysfunction that starts with insulin resistance. So you get insulin resistance, it ends up in type 2 diabetes. Okay, so around the turn of the century, what happened? Things drastically changed regarding human health. Okay, so remember, beginning of this, of the 20th century, we were eating 99% of our diet, 99% of our fat was saturated fat, and we had no heart disease, we had no diabetes, we had no obesity, we had very little cancer. In the late 19th century, we saw the invention of a process to refine vegetable and seed oils. So the first vegetable oil was created in 1865. It was cottonseed oil. Refined sugar was invented in 1822. A process to refine wheat flour was created in 1880. And in 1911, Crisco invented our first trans fat. Processed seed and vegetable oils, refined sugar, refined flour, and trans fats are the four ultra-processed foods. In 2009, 63% of the U.S. diet consisted of these four foods. So two-thirds of the diet is these ultra-processed foods. Processed seed, vegetable oils, refined sugar, refined flour, and trans fats. And 75% of the U.S. diet is processed food. So not ultra processed, but processed is like Doritos, like made of like corn chips, you know, pizza. So what happened to our health? By 2015, 39.8% of the U.S. population is now considered obese, which is an endocrine disorder. 10% have full-blown diabetes, and about 30% have prediabetes. 88% of the North American population has some sort of insulin resistance. 88% of people. So if you are in the 12% of people that has normal fasting insulin, normal fasting glucose, and a normal HOMA-IR score, you're in the vast minority. Remember, diabetes was almost non-existent when we were eating saturated fat. Now we're all insulin resistant. And what are we eating? White sugar, flour, and trans fat intake has climbed. The biggest drastic change to our diet, though, is processed vegetable oils. Okay, this is the major change to our diet in the last century. In 1900, we consumed only about 2 grams of these oils a day, right? That was back when we were eating 99% of our fats from animals, saturated fats from animals, eggs, milk, lard, all these foods that you're told not to eat because they're so bad for you. This is most of our diet. We had no disease. In 2010, that number went up to 80 grams per day. So we went from 2 grams of vegetable oils to 80 grams of vegetable oils a day. 86% of our fats now come from these processed seed oils. So 88% of us have insulin resistance and 88% of our oils come from these seed vegetable oils. 99% of the oils or fats that we consumed before were saturated fat. We didn't have any diabetes or insulin resistance. 32% of our total caloric intake are these processed seed and vegetable oils. So what are they? Okay. So first you take some sort of seed or vegetable or grain, canola, corn, sunflower, cottonseed, safflower, peanut, soybeans. You cleanse them, you grind them, you press them. You extract the fats with these chemical solvents. You deodorize them because now they're rancid and they don't smell good. And this oily liquid goes through a series of other steps. So it gets bleached, further deodorized, further refined, and then they end up in your table in the form of corn oil, canola oil, margarine, which is a hydrogenated version of these terrible oils, soybean oil, and so on. So after this podcast, go to your kitchen, do it right now, and look at anything you have that's in a package or bag and see if you can find any of these oils. Your Beyond Beef burger has canola oil. Your crackers, they have whatever, vegetable oil or soybean oil. Take a look. Your chips have canola or vegetable or corn oil. So these oils contain omega-6 polyunsaturated fats, which once made up only about 2% of our total diet. And back then we had virtually no diabetes, heart disease, or cancer. They accumulate in fat cells, so particularly a fat called linoleic acid, which now makes up about 21.5% of our fat tissue, which is more than double what it was in 1959. And so if you want, I'm going to leave a link in the show notes to a 30-minute YouTube that's called the $100 billion ingredient making your food toxic. So there's a man called Chris Nam, and he talks about all of these statistics in his book, The Omega-6 Apocalypse. And of course, these stats are all correlation. We don't know what caused this increase in disease or if it was related to this drastic change in our food, this like 180 of our food. We know that correlation doesn't equal causation. We're going to be talking about this again. But there are many more pieces of data that indicate that this abrupt change in seed oil consumption, what Dr. Nam calls the single greatest change to nutrition in all of history, and this link to metabolic dysfunction and chronic disease. So these oils, the problem with them is that they go rancid at room temperature. So they cause oxidation in our blood vessels. They contain little to no nutritional value. They have no fat-soluble vitamins like tallow and ghee and grass-fed butter. They contain vitamins A, D, E, and K. They contain stearic acid, which we'll talk about. They don't contain polyphenols. They don't contain anything good. They just contain pro-oxidants. They're already oxidized. They damage a protein in our mitochondria called cardiolipin, which forms the electron transport chain. So they prevent our mitochondria from being able to make energy. And this is likely what's causing insulin resistance in our society. So insulin resistance previously has been blamed on sugar, which can fuel the fire. But something has to start the fire, and likely mitochondrial damage caused by these vegetable oils is the thing that's causing insulin resistance. So we're not able to burn fat. We're not able to generate energy from our cells. We're not able to utilize glucose properly. And this herein lies the problem. Damaged mitochondria at the microscopic level are the common factor in damaged metabolism and metabolic and inflammatory diseases like heart disease, cancer, and diabetes. And a diet high in omega-6 polyunsaturated fatty acids is well known to be inflammatory. We need to balance our omega-6s with omega-3s that are more anti-inflammatory, but there's only so much balancing we can do if 86% of our diet is omega-6 polyunsaturated fat. You know, we weren't meant necessarily to be eating so much polyunsaturated fat, whether it's omega-3 or 6. These foods they're hard to get in nature. Yes, omega-3s are really important for our brain. Omega-6s have a place in our health too. They are essential fatty acids. But we need stronger cell membranes. We need the saturated fat to help coat our nerves. We need more stable oils like the saturated fats that don't get oxidized and that don't cause this inflammation. So our omega-6-to-3 ratio is about 10 to 1. It should be about 1 to 1. And this pushes arachidonic acid in the body, which pushes more inflammation. And we know inflammation, insulin resistance, these are the drivers of disease in Western culture. And even conversations around high cholesterol, like high LDL, is only a problem. LDL is like the quote, bad cholesterol. High LDL is only a problem in the presence of inflammation and insulin resistance. And so we have to be very careful when we're looking at cholesterol markers. And so what is very important is your HDL in your cholesterol. HDL is correlated with insulin sensitivity. So the higher your HDL, presumably the more insulin sensitive you are. The lower your HDL, the more insulin resistant you might be. So what we've been told about cholesterol is not the whole story. We've been told that saturated fat, even dietary cholesterol, raise our cholesterol, and that clogs our heart and causes heart disease. What we're learning now is that heart disease never existed when we were eating tons of saturated fat and cholesterol. It exists now that we're eating these highly refined, processed, disgusting seed oils. If I sound passionate, it's because I am. They're terrible. It's terrible. And we've been lied to because we've been told that they're heart healthy oils and they're a disaster for our health. So linoleic acid is the omega-6 polyunsaturated fat. It's an essential, which means that our body doesn't make it on its own. So we actually do need to get some from the diet to make our other omega-6 polyunsaturated fats. But we're just eating way too much of it because of all of these omega-6 fats from these seed oils that we're consuming. And so it's associated with an increase in abdominal fat, fatty liver, and metabolic dysfunction. And its opposite is stearic acid, which creates more abdominal, so it's a little bit confusing, but stearic acid creates insulin resistance of the abdominal fat. Linoleic acid creates insulin sensitivity of the abdominal fat. So linoleic acid encourages deposition, so an increase in abdominal fat, and stearic acid that's found in tallow, suet, and cocoa butter, of all things, does the opposite. And so the theory of this is sort of like what I was talking about when I was describing that sense of abundance and richness from eating meat that may have been this primal response. That I'm just speculating, but it's something I notice in my body, in my patients. So when we had a large kill, we would eat presumably lots of tallow from the animal, from the ruminant that we killed, and our levels of stearic acid would go up. And so our body's like, great, there's lots of abundance. Let's engage in fat burning and energy utilization. When it was end of season and, you know, all the animals are dead, it's winter time, and all we have to subsist on are nuts, acorns, these seeds that we would have got from we would have got some seeds from nature, right? But we, you know, to get seeds, again, high in phytic acid, high in oxalates, we have to, plants don't necessarily want us to eat their seeds. So they do have defense chemicals and anti-nutrients. And so we'd have to soak, sprout, grind, cook these seeds. And they were high in linoleic acid. So they tell our body to hibernate. Think of like a squirrel gathering nuts, gaining weight. And so this likely there's this signal between stearic acid and linoleic acid. And there's this man, Brad Marshall. He has a diet. He has a book called The Croissant Diet. And so he goes more into the relationship between linoleic acid and stearic acid. So he made himself these croissants with that were high in stearic acid and lost a ton of weight. And typically he found it takes about 6 weeks to start shifting the fatty acids in our cells to start getting this boost in metabolism. That's an interesting thought. If you want to learn more about it, look at my course, UA Less on the Moon, where we go into this. So let's get back to the vegetable oil. So you find them in soybean oil, sunflower oil, canola oil, corn vegetable oil, peanut oil, safflower oil, margarine, Crisco, cottonseed oil, peanut oil, which I already mentioned, and also grain-fed chicken and pork. So pork fat, very high in linoleic acid, just the way that pigs have been genetically modified and bred. And so monogastric animals will, when fed grains, will make a lot of linoleic acid. So it's something to be wary of. Beef, very low in linoleic acid, essentially non-existent. So tallow, ghee, grass-fed butter, all good sources. So you're going to find these restaurants as the cooking oil. You're going to find these oils as the cooking oil in every restaurant you go to, even in the salads. It's going to be in the salad dressings that you find off the grocery shelf. It's going to be in your mayo, crackers, cookies, chips. Look at everything packaged. It's going to contain some of those oils. Store-bought hummus, vegan bowl, vegan dressing. And yeah, so the only way to really get rid of them is to make as much of your own food as possible. Start lobbying. And by that, I just mean like voting with your dollar, like buy yourself some tallow, cook with butter, cook with, you can cook with coconut oil, olive oil, and avocado oil, but avoid these oils at all cost. And let's start liberating saturated fat. So when we were eating, when we experienced less disease, we were eating more saturated fat, animal fats. And so we know that correlation doesn't equal causation, but in order for causation to occur, there must be correlation. So if you see that we went from 99% of our diet of saturated fat with very little disease to now like very little of our diet is saturated fat, 86% are these seed oils, we have tons of disease, there's something going on. There's no correlation between saturated fat and negative health outcomes. We see a decreased risk in stroke from saturated fat intake. We don't see a clear correlation between saturated fat intake and heart disease. We might see a raise in LDL, but remember, LDL, aka our quote, bad cholesterol, might only be bad in the presence of insulin resistance. And so it's the insulin resistance we want to deal with. And the insulin resistance is coming from things like magnesium deficiency, stress, seed oils, and refined foods like refined carbohydrates and sugars, refined sugars. So yeah, we've been told for decades that these oils are good for us. And the problem with nutritional research that's frustrating, because maybe you're frustrated listening to all this, you can fit the data to reflect any story you want. But the truth is that vegetable oils are incredibly inexpensive and widespread throughout the diet. So they're everywhere. And really the problem is that we've become very focused on ultra processed food in our diet. And this has led to exactly what we talked about, the main causes of disease, which are nutrient deficiencies, because these foods don't contain any nutrients that we need to thrive, and toxicities. These foods are toxic. They damage our mitochondria. And this makes it difficult for our metabolisms to work, leading to insulin resistance, inflammation, chronic disease, and however that manifests. So, you know, it's hard to take these oils out, but switching to more saturated fat is not probably a bad thing. So I also want to talk about autoimmunity and inflammation. So chronic inflammation runs rampant in many of our bodies. It's driving disease. And really, we have a pandemic of inflammation and insulin resistance in our society. And this is driving everything you see, from endometriosis to depression to schizophrenia to lupus to eczema, right? So inflammation is at the root of most chronic health complaints, if not all, mental health conditions, hormonal conditions, cardiovascular disease. They're essentially inflammatory in nature. And this inflammation confuses our immune system and keeps our immune system chronically active. So what we often do when we see patients with inflammation is we look at what can we, so we look at through that lens of excess and deficiency. So what nutrient deficiencies might be there? Vitamin D is very important. Magnesium is important. EPA. And then we're also thinking, like, is there a food that is triggering the immune system, right? Because we know that leaky gut, and if you want to learn more about leaky gut, the course, the guide to food sensitivities and elimination diets is one to check out. But essentially, our gut becomes inflamed, irritated. It lets food particles into the circulation, and that confuses it and creates immune system issues. And so common foods that we take out are things like gluten. We take out dairy because of the casein, which can cause leaky gut. Gluten can cause, it activates a protein called zonulin that can cause leaky gut. We take out, very often we take out soy. Sometimes we take out eggs. We take out things like peanuts. And the autoimmune paleo diet removes, which is very anti-inflammatory, removes all grains, all nuts and seeds, all legumes. Because of the potential, these anti-nutrients can irritate the gut, especially lectins that are associated with autoimmune disease. And so what that leaves us ultimately is like green veggies, rice, or very non-invasive, non-difficult grains, like white rice. It's not very inflammatory. And then you have beef, meat, chicken, fish. And so these foods, like I have run, and so these IgG food sensitivity tests, a lot of criticism leveled at them. I used to run them back in the day a lot more than I do now. And meat, animal, they never came up. I never once saw IgG activation of meat. So meat, it is well broken down. It does not trigger the immune system. And it's also low residue. So there's actually a woman, Michaela Peterson, someone to check out, who had severe autoimmune conditions lifelong, required joint replacements. She's severely depressed, who went on a carnivore diet. So she started off on an elimination diet. Then she boiled her diet down to just like greens and beef. And now it's just beef. I think she's added honey back in, but she was on this all meat diet. So not necessarily suggested. But one of the things that it did was lower any residue, lower any immune system activation, and all of her immune symptoms cleared up. Her depression cleared up. So a really incredible transformation of going on this all meat diet. And so we hear sometimes that meat is inflammatory, and that is simply not the case. Never activates IgG, which is an antibody associated with food sensitivities. I haven't seen it ever activate histamine reactions or allergies. And actually, DAO, an enzyme that breaks down histamine, is found in kidney. So if you have allergies, you might consider kidney supplementing or eating kidney. And it's low residue, so it doesn't create irritation of the digestive system. It gets absorbed pretty high up in our digestive tract, and all of it gets absorbed. It doesn't leave behind any residue. Now, some people and some of my patients will say things like, I can't digest meat, or meat aggravates my symptoms. And what I want to say here is going on is that this usual, so protein is digested in the stomach. And in order to digest protein, we need enough stomach acid. This podcast is really long. I'm almost done, but there's still more I got to cover. So If you took stomach acid from your stomach and dropped it on your shoe, it would burn a hole through your shoe. The stomach acid is, our stomach acid is, it has a pH about 2 or 3. It's extremely acidic, extremely low pH. And that's normal. And what that does is it burns through our food. It burns through our protein. So protein digestion happens in the stomach. And many of us have irritation of the stomach, issues with stomach motility. We don't have enough stomach acid. We have leaky sphincters causing heartburn, even though we actually don't even have enough stomach acid. And many of us are zinc deficient. And so there's a difference between the digestive system not being able to tolerate a food that has no inflammatory potential and a food being bad for the digestive system. And I will admit that I would rather support someone's digestion than take their foods away. So I'm more akin to adding versus subtracting, but it's important to pay attention to that meat is likely not aggravating your symptoms. And if you consume meat and you don't feel good after, then addressing the stomach and supporting stomach acid production and possibly zinc and adding more protein in slowly so that your body gets used to digesting it. Likely you haven't been eating much protein and that's been downgrading your stomach acid production. So looking at the actual digestive machinery is important there. Same goes for fat digestion. So when they have high fat diets, if they feel nauseous or if they have diarrhea or if they see loose sort of oily stools, then you want to think of, or gallbladder attacks, you want to think of adding choline in. Likely there's a choline deficiency happening. So these are obviously more complex, but these are just two clinical pearls. So that being said, if you're vegan, vegetarian, it's basically impossible to do a very anti-inflammatory diet. So even though vegan, vegetarian diets are often touted as anti-inflammatory, it's sort of like when we think anti-inflammatory, you think like all the colorful veggies. When you think nutrient dense, you think of all the colorful veggies. You're not really thinking liver meat, but that's reality. It's very interesting. Okay, so what about all of these studies that say that vegetarianism and veganism are healthy and they have all these healthy health benefits and that meat is terrible for us and causes like colon cancer and stuff. Okay, so you have to be aware that a lot of the studies showing a vegan vegetarian diet are healthy are comparing their diets to the standard American diet. And remember, it's 65% ultra processed food that they're comparing it to. So if you take a diet of pizza and chicken wings and seed oils, and you add a couple carrots and you take away the chicken wings and you add some carrots, like you're going to be healthier because you've added some nutrients that whereas before there were none. So you have to look at like, what are they comparing the diet to? You also want to look at, so like to paint the picture better, coffee is the number one source of antioxidants in the United States. It's insane. So no one's eating fruits and vegetables. No one's eating liver, organ meats. No one's eating fat-soluble vitamins. They're eating seed oils. They're eating refined flours. They're eating refined sugars. And they're eating Crisco, trans fats. So we also have to be, aware of like, what are they comparing the diet to when they say it's healthy? And then when they're saying that meat is bad, you have to be aware of something called the healthy user bias and the unhealthy user bias. So the problem with nutritional data is it's epidemiological, it's correlational. And with correlation, you have to be careful because you can correlate anything with anything. Like for example, apparently the more TV sets you own in Sweden, the more tax you pay. And that kind of makes sense, right? Because you're like, well, there's probably a causal factor there where if you own more TV sets, maybe you're richer and so therefore you pay more tax. But owning more TV sets won't increase your tax and selling your TV sets won't allow you to pay less tax. So you gotta be careful with these correlations. There's a correlation between ice cream and drowning. Both happen in the summer, but you know, going on an ice cream diet's not going to increase your water safety. So you also have to be careful of these biases that can show up in epidemiology. And a very important one is the healthy user bias and the unhealthy user bias, right? So if you've been told your whole life that eating red meat is not good for you, you're going to avoid it if you are a healthy person. And who's going to eat red meat? People who go to Harvey's, people who ride Harley Davidsons and smoke and have bottles of whiskey on the weekend and that kind of thing, right? So it's like barbecue people, like it's bad, it's sinful, it's grills. And nobody goes to McDonald's and just gets a beef patty, right? You're getting, if you're eating red meat, you're probably eating seed oil drenched fries and refined wheat buns with like folic acid that affects your methylation cycle. And then you're having a double, like one of those giant Cokes with high fructose corn syrup. That's, and then you have a tiny little beef patty, and that's what gets blamed for whatever health outcome results from eating that way over time. And then similarly, there's the healthy user bias, where if you're told that meat is bad for you and you're healthy, you're like, okay, a vegetarian diet's healthy. Well, who do you know who's vegetarian? Do they do yoga? Do they get to bed on time? Do they meditate? Are they into like, you know, organic stuff? Like these are people who have many healthy habits, very likely. And there's this criticism, like the Seventh-day Adventists are a long living population in Loma Linda, California. So they're like a blue zone. So they have a high rate of centenarians, people who live over 100, and they're a vegetarian. And they live longer. It's like, oh, it's probably their diet, but they also have more social connection. They have spirituality. They don't smoke. They don't drink. If you compare them to the Mormons in Utah who eat meat, they have similar longevity and similar health. So you have to be careful with these healthy user biases, because the Mormons, they eat meat, but they also don't drink, smoke, they have community, all that stuff. So you have to be aware of messaging in Asia. So you go to Japan, you go to China, like Hong Kong, there isn't this association with meat and ill health. And so you actually don't see these connections between more red meat equals more X disease. You actually see the reverse. So there's more, better health correlated with more red meat consumption in these countries, because red meat is probably a sign of wealth and prosperity. And so again, correlated with better health. So you have to be really careful of associative data. Always be wary. If you ever see like 16% increase in whatever, be aware of what that study might be saying, and ask some questions about it. Because most nutritional studies, unfortunately, when you dig down in them, they're disappointing. And so like with this one, we're using correlation, right, with the seed oil thing. There's correlation here, but we also have biological mechanisms. And right, so it's like, okay, well, they damage cardiolipin, they have no nutrients, they're inflammatory, they're oxidized, they're not natural, they're like degraded and processed. It's disgusting how they're produced. They're not part of our ancient diet. We never ate that way before. As soon as we added them, all this disease skyrocketed. And so we start to see there's more levels to the evidence tree. And we have something called the hierarchy of evidence, and we have epidemiology in that hierarchy. At the very top, we have meta-analyses. So a combination of randomized control trials where you take, you know, a healthy person. So when you do studies where you take, you know, two healthy populations, both doing exactly the same thing, and one is eating meat, one is eating like something else, and then you compare them. We have very few of those studies, but whenever we study people like that, there's no difference in the health of the people that eat meat versus no. Again, the colon cancer thing, that's another one, right? So red meat causes colon cancer, fully correlational. And even those correlations didn't show. So there actually was no correlation. The studies were cherry picked. And we'll talk a little bit later, but there's some politics involved as well. So what about animals? What about animal rights? So one of my friends at naturopathic school, a lot of us were vegetarians when we first started. And then we took second year nutrition with Dr. Phil Reschutis. And we pretty much stopped being vegetarian after that. Like he led us through just a bunch of examples, like how many seeds you'd have to eat. Like it was something like 2000 calories of seeds and legumes in order to get a basic amount of protein in your diet. And just his clinical data that he, like his clinical experience, where he said that every single young female patient he had who was depressed or anxious was vegetarian or vegan. And I have to admit, probably 80% of my young patients with depression and anxiety are vegan, vegetarian, or just not eating enough meat. So you can chew on that, I guess. So my friend, She was vegan when she came to naturopathic college, the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine. She was a vegan. She had like a sticker on her book that said, save everything, be vegan. And then she started eating meat because she was experiencing a lot of health issues. And she told me, I still love animals, but I love myself more. There's something to consider because there cannot be life without death. Mufasa said it to Simba in The Lion King. He said, we're all connected in the great circle of life. We eat the antelope eat the grass. When we die, our bodies become the grass. We're all connected. So I love animals. I have a dog, Coco. I believe that we should be kind to animals. I believe we are animals. I also believe that we are disconnected from our food, and our food is given to us too easily, and we don't have this reverence or this spiritual connection to the fact that a life was lost in order for us to thrive. But there is this fact of life, and I think that that reality or that lack of reality affects us. Really, few of us feel the impact of the sacrifices that the earth makes to feed us. Like, we don't hunt. Few of us hunt. Few of us have ever slaughtered an animal. I never slaughtered an animal for food. But few vegetarians or vegans have clear-cut forests to plant monocrops and tilled the soil. And, you know, and few have driven grain turbines over soy fields, and in doing so killed rabbits and mice and voles. And so animals die in food production, and it's unfortunate. I think we need to do a better job as a society in respecting that and treating the animals as best as we can. So no matter if you're vegan or an omnivore, we're still killing animals in order for us to survive. And I believe there's a way that we can do this more humanely. I obviously advocate for avoiding factory farms. I advocate for investigating where the animals, where the meat that you're consuming, where those animals are coming from, how they're raised, forging relationships with local farms that grass feed their cows, that care for them properly, that slaughter them humanely. Obviously, this factory farm model, this industrial method, this monocrop agriculture, all this stuff that is not solved by simply not eating meat, because then you turn to the monocrop agriculture. All of this industrial farming is terrible for our health and our life and for animals. But I believe we need meat. It's not just I believe. I mean, the argument, I think, is pretty strong for meat. They're just nutrients that you're not going to get if you're not eating meat. So what about the environment? So we hear, and I have many friends, like I said, that avoid red meat because it's bad for the environment because of methane, carbon production, and the water table. So where did this come from? Because I was always confused about this. And so you look at who is promoting this because cows and ruminants, there were millions of buffalo on the American plains. And those buffalo have all died as their home has been taken away. All those plains are now desert, and we have the Dust Bowl. And so we had millions of buffalo. We had millions of ruminants over the land. And how could cows be ruining the environment? So this is something that's always been weird to me. So you have something called the EAT Lancet, E-A-T Lancet. And so this is this environmental organization that is involved and invested in getting the planet fed. So they have something called the Planetary Health Diet. You should look at it. So the Planetary Health Diet has a plate, and half the plate is vegetables, which is wonderful. But think about that. I mean, you're not, when we think of nutrient density, kale is or leafy greens are number 7 on the list. We know that that plants have nutrients, and they have fiber, and they have phytochemicals and different things. But they also contain anti-nutrients. So half your plate is vegetables, fine. But what else are you eating? How else are you getting your nutrients? Okay, well, a good chunk of that diet they advocate for is, they call it them unsaturated plant oils. So seed oils, vegetable oils. That's horrific. to say that that's good for the planet. And then you have a good chunk is plant sourced protein, which we know is not as bioavailable or as good quality as animal protein, and also contains anti-nutrients. So it's, you're not going to absorb any zinc if you're consuming most of your protein as plant sourced protein. You're not absorbing your magnesium. You're not absorbing your iron or your calcium. And then they have a sliver dedicated to processed sugars. So it's a horrific diet. It's actually an absolutely terrible diet. How would I frame a diet? I would probably say like a healthy diet contains a serving of some sort of protein from animals. So eggs, meat, some sort of starch or fruit, and then vegetables, not seed oils and healthy and fats, right? So, so cooking your food in tallow or ghee or olive oil, enough saturated fats to create your cell membranes, and then maybe supplementing with organs or eating organs if you do, if you like that. So a horrible diet, this planetary health diet, absolutely horrific. Telling you to eat all of your oils from plants, from seed oils and refined sugar. It's disgusting. So who is sponsoring this endeavor? Well, if you look at the list, you see people like Nestle, you see Kellogg's, you see Google, you see Monsanto or Bayer. Now Monsanto is called Bayer. And just a long list of companies that we should not be taking food advice from, and companies that are invested in getting us to eat processed industrial plant foods from the monocrops. So this is a reality, I think, is that we're being given nutrition advice from industry that has a vested interest in this. I had a friend who, he went to a summit in Winnipeg, and the summit was to create more protein from plants. And so they were talking about how they're going to get protein from canola oil and make, you know, plant sources of protein. Now, are you absorb what protein from canola oil is like getting seeds from canola. So you probably have to deodorize. It's probably some sludge that is full of anti-nutrients, the protein is probably low quality, and is it better for the environment? Well, let's look at this. Okay, so the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in 2016, they reported that, so of all the greenhouse gases produced, 1.9% of total greenhouse gases come from cows. Plant agriculture and crops, 5.7%. Okay, so it's not even half that. It's less than half that of plant agriculture and crops that goes into, that creates greenhouse gases. So cows produce 1.9% of total greenhouse gases. Transportation, just for contrast, is 26%. So methane, so this, the idea, right, is that cow farts are creating greenhouse gases. So cows, they ferment and they produce methane, but methane that cows produce, as well as water, so it says cows take up this much water to produce this much beef, they're part of the carbon cycle in the water table. So the carbon cycle, the methane cycle from cows is a fixed cycle. So cows, they eat grass, they produce methane, their poo lands on the grass, that carbon goes back into the soil. So it's this process. So cows drink water, then they pee, it goes back into the water table. It doesn't contribute to an overall loss of water that much, and it doesn't increase carbon in the atmosphere overall. So so our Earth should have about 2 meters of topsoil. Okay. 2 meters of topsoil. So in the Fertile Crescent in the Mediterranean, it used to be fertile. Now it's a desert. It used to be lush and fertile, like its name. In the U.S., we talked about the Dust Bowl. That used to be fertile land. 2 meters of topsoil and these perennial grasses with deep root networks. Okay, the soil, that 2 meters of topsoil, was full of organisms. It was full of water. And these organisms produce water, and they help maintain water in the soil. They fix nitrogen. They loosen the soil to allow plant roots to penetrate. And they And so this topsoil, like these perennial grasses, they coexisted, co-evolved with ruminants. So when cows break down the grasses through grazing, the plants go into the ground, their seeds are released. They feed the microbes, they fix carbon. And this process of regenerative agriculture is putting cows back on the land to regenerate the topsoil. So what happens when we say, okay, we want to clear cut that, we want to get rid of this, we want to get rid of all these grasses, and we want to plant corn, soy, wheat. We want to plant these monocrops, these industrial monocrops. So what happens is we rip up that 2 meters of topsoil, and now we have about 60 years of topsoil left. 40% is degraded, 70% of it is completely gone. This soil is stripped of carbon. The carbon's now in the atmosphere. It's less robust. It affects the water table. It causes flooding. It causes soil erosion, issues with irrigation, it making it impossible to water plants. And they think that the new conflicts in Southeast Asia are going to be related to soil irrigation issues. Time magazine writes, modern wheat varieties have half the micronutrients of older strains, and it's pretty much the same for fruit and vegetables. The focus has been on breeding high-yield crops, which can survive on degraded soil, so it's hardly surprising that 60% of the world's population is deficient in nutrients like iron. If it's not in the soil, it's not in our food. A study from the National Academy of Sciences estimated that we've lost 133 billion tons of carbon from soil erosion since the agricultural revolution. So we rip up this topsoil. Now we have to put synthetic and chemical fertilizers into the ground. We're losing topsoil. So what we're doing now with agriculture can't continue. So what's the answer? So the answer is regenerative agriculture. We need to regenerate the soil. The Biggest Little Farm, have you seen that on Netflix? It's really, it made me cry. So regenerative agriculture is like building back the land, building back the soil, and ruminants help us do that. So the ruminants, they're grazing animals, right? They help sequester carbon. They can reverse deserts. You put them on grass because grasses grow in sort of like a slow, accelerated and slow manner. So you put them on the grass when it's in its accelerated growth, and it accrues biomass at this middle stage. And so the cows are eating it while it has this increased biomass. They're helping fix the nitrogen by releasing the seeds deep into the grass. We have these deep root networks. They're pooping, and then they're trampling on the soil and trampling their poop down to create more topsoil. They're natural fertilizer machines, cows. So a man called Dennis Hancock, he estimates that we could sequester 4.5 tons of carbon a year back into the soil with better livestock agriculture practices. And this is the equivalent of taking 3.4 billion cars off the road. So 3.4 billion cars off the road a year by having cows poop on the earth and eat grass. And 25% of the land on the planet is not suitable for growing crops anyways. And so it's perfect for livestock agriculture. And so the cows, what they do is they take this inedible cellulose from plants that we can't digest, and then they turn them into steaks and organ meats that contain all the nutrients that we talked about, the zinc, the magnesium, the fat soluble vitamins, the B vitamins, the fatty acids. We don't need fertilizer. We don't need to tillage the land. We don't need to ruin the topsoil. We actually can build back the topsoil with the bacteria, with the microbes, with the nitrogen. And cows are doing that with the nitrogen from their poo and their hooves. And, you know, so this idea with the methane only, when you look at regenerative agriculture, so Beyond Beef, to make a pound of Beyond Beef burger takes 4 pounds of carbon. So it releases 4 pounds of carbon into the atmosphere. When you regeneratively farm beef, so there's a company called White Oak Pastures in the US that has regenerative farming practices. To produce a pound of beef, they actually sequester 3.5 pounds of carbon. So it's a negative carbon output. They're actually, by raising beef, they're reducing carbon output into the atmosphere. So please, when we're talking about cows being bad for the environment, we have to be very careful with buying that. So this idea that the way we've eaten for millions of years is somehow destroying the planet isn't the way forward. We know that big industry is behind a lot of the initiative to feed the earth, feed the people on earth, this toxic nutrient-devoid diet of seed oils and refined sugar. We know that we've eaten meat for millions of years, that meat contains, we've co-evolved with meat. Meat has contributed to bigger brain size. It's has the same nutrients that we have. Like all of the nutrients your liver needs are in a cow liver. And in Chinese medicine, if your kidneys are, if you lack kidney qi or you lack liver qi, they recommend you eat kidney and liver. Makes sense. When you eat liver, you're getting choline and B vitamins and vitamin A, retinol, actual vitamin A. And that's what your liver needs too. Not only that, but organ meats also contain peptides. So these are nutrients. These are biochemical compounds that we haven't even fully studied yet. So compounds like BPC-157, this wolverine peptide that encourages bone and tissue growth and regeneration, is found in stomach. And so eating these foods can deliver us these peptides. Meat is a natural diet for humans. When we look at meat, our brain gets excited, no matter how we identify. It helps our brains grow. It created the beings that we are today. It created humanity. It contains the nutrients in the forms and the bioavailability that our bodies need to grow and to thrive. Those who don't eat meat lack these nutrients, or they are in a place where they need to find these nutrients, probably from synthetic sources. And in the case of vitamin D, from animal source anyways, they tend to suffer more depression and anxiety and nutrient deficiencies and possibly health issues. And meat has gotten a terrible rap over the years. And it's time to correct that. It's time to really investigate the narrative around meat, of it being bad for our health, bad for the environment, bad for animals. There are ways that we can improve. And I believe that we should work to improve that. And if we're investing in getting seed oils off our shelves and out of our food, if we're investing in regenerative agriculture and supporting farms that are doing this, that are putting carbon back in the soil and out of the atmosphere, essentially taking these cars off the road, like it's incredible what they're doing. This is really important. And so this is something that we need to work to resolve. We need to eat meat. We need to be responsible for how we consume it. And we need to be supporting these people, these initiatives. And I think this is the way forward, where we can feed the earth a nutrient-rich diet. We can restore our health and we can save the health of the planet. So meat, play, love. It's our human right. And thank you guys for listening.